Well, good evening. Welcome. I'm Dr. Thad Polk. I'm Associate Chair of the Department of Psychology at Michigan, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to our speaker this evening, Dr. Patricia Guerin. Dr. Guerin is the Nancy Cantor Distinguished University Professor Emerita of Psychology and Women's Studies at the University of Michigan. She was also named an Arthur F. Thurnau Professor for her outstanding contributions to undergraduate education. And she was also a longtime chair of the psychology department, including 20 years ago when I was hired, so she will always have a very special place in my heart. Her research has focused on social identity and its role in political attitudes, in motivation, in intergroup relations. She's the author of 8 books and monographs and numerous articles on these topics. And she also served as an expert witness in the University of Michigan's defense of its undergraduate and law school admissions policy, which went to the Supreme Court, as you may remember. So she and a number of her colleagues actually provided the expert report on the educational value of diversity for those lawsuits. Tonight she's going to be talking about crossing racial and social divides. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Patricia Guerin.
For those of you who don't know Thad Polk, he's one of the best instructors we have at the university. He teaches cognitive psychology. Don't take it from anybody else. And Patty Reuter-Lorenz, who's our department chair, is also here. Patty, could you stand up? So I'm delighted to be part of this psychology department library collaboration. It's a terrific idea. And it's really a great honor, especially since I'm already an emeritus, that I'm part of this group of people who have been coming here once a month since September. So we'll get started, and I want to explain that we're really going to focus primarily on race tonight. It calls race and other social divides, and that's for 2 reasons. One is that most of the research done by social psychologists turns out in intergroup relations to be done involving race. And secondly, there's just no question about it. Race is the major social divide in the United States. It has been, it is, and it will be. So what am I going to do tonight? Well, the context is the call often for a national conversation on race. I want to talk a little bit about that context and give you some examples of it in the past 20 years. And then, do we have such conversations in any of our families, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, our places of worship? And if we don't, why don't we? What's going on that makes it so hard to have these conversations across race, especially about race? Then I want to focus a little bit on what psychologists know about both the positives and the challenges of these crossing of divides, racial and others, and give an example of a program that I've been involved in for many years, intergroup dialogue at the University of Michigan, which is an example of ways in which we can learn to talk about race across race. So that's what we're going to be doing. I want to say just a personal word, because I've mentioned the word intergroup dialogue. 27 years ago, I helped found this program, and then I got very busy doing lots of other things. But after I so-called retired in 2002, I went back to the program on intergroup relations and got fully engaged again, both with teaching and doing a national study on the impact of intergroup dialogue, which I'll talk very briefly about tonight. So it's a program that's dear to my heart, and I think you will see that it's done a great deal of good at the University of Michigan in helping students learn how to talk and how to collaborate across many social divides. All right, let's start with President Clinton. 1997, the first President Clinton. In 1997, President Clinton said, "We must begin with a candid conversation on the state of race relations today in the United States and the implications of Americans of so many different races and ethnicities living together and working together as we approach the new century." We must be honest with each other, he said. We talk at each other and we talk about each other, but we rarely talk with each other. It's high time, he said, that we began to have a conversation about race. And so he established a thing called the National Initiative on Race. And here he is with a group of his staff people with the goals of the Initiative on Race: to educate the nation about race, to promote a constructive dialogue, to confront and work through difficult and controversial issues, encourage leadership to bridge divides, and to develop and implement solutions in a great many arenas of life. Well, in fact, we know that the race initiative really went nowhere. Go forward to the decision on the Trayvon Martin case, and we have President Clinton talking to us about a national conversation on race.
Yeah, there have been talk about should we convene a conversation on race. I haven't seen that be particularly productive when politicians try to organize conversations. They end up being stilted and politicized, and folks are locked into the positions they already have. On the other hand, in families and churches and workplaces, there's the possibility that people are a little bit more honest, and at least you ask yourself your own questions about, am I wringing as much bias out of myself as I can? Am I judging people as much as I can based on not the color of their skin, but the content of their character? That would, I think, be an appropriate exercise in the wake of this tragedy.
Well, he has had many occasions to talk similarly since the Trayvon Martin case. And here are some of the reasons why. All kinds of racially based violence, often by white police, but it's not exclusively that. And here's just a sort of collage of some of those famous names that we now all know. And most recently, James Comey, who's the first FBI director to talk about race, in a speech in which he was trying not to let law enforcement off the hook, he nonetheless said that we need a national discussion about real and perceived biases, both inside and outside law enforcement. And here's how we typically have our conversations about race. So Matt Villasagamos, writing in The Atlantic and talking about why it's so hard to talk about race, comments that even when we do talk about race, it is usually with people who look like us. But an intimate conversation without people from other backgrounds, other racial and ethnic backgrounds, doesn't leave us room to develop empathy, to gain different perspectives, and to much less even learn how to listen. So I want to tell a personal story. Well, let me first talk about some examples in which we do, in fact, have positive examples of talking about race. Everyday Democracy is a national organization, was called Study Circles for many years. These are local conversations focused on some kind of local problem. They're run in places like libraries and places of worship all over the country, and they're very often about race and how race works in that community. There have recently been some very positive Atlanta race dialogues that have been conducted. Eli Lilly as a company has done some very interesting race discussions within that company. And then the year that LSNA had race as our LSNA theme for the semester, or maybe it was a year even, IJR and numerous other people on the campus ran community dialogues about race in Ann Arbor. But it's rare, and even when it happens, people tend to see things differently. Catherine Walsh, who's a political scientist, has written a book called Talking Race, says that, and she was doing it on a study of everyday democracy, that, well, these folks were about to voluntarily take part in an interracial discussion, not a typical behavior for most Americans, and they were not just engaging in interracial discussion, they were doing so about race. Bringing up the topic of race in interracial settings is generally treated, she says, as a potential for disaster by politicians and ordinary citizens alike. Well, why? I think there's two big reasons. There are many others, and one is the continued racial segregation residentially in this country, where we don't really all live together. And secondly, a pretty widespread belief in colorblindness. Our Justice Roberts, in many of the opinions that he's written, makes it clear that he believes in colorblindness, and if it doesn't exist, it should exist, and we shouldn't pay any attention to race. So here's a picture, very briefly, of continued segregation. Nearly half of African Americans in metropolitan areas live in conditions of hypersegregation, in homogeneous neighborhoods where contact with people who are not like them is uncommon. However, of all racial groups, whites are the most likely to live in racially homogeneous communities and least likely to come into contact with people unlike themselves. And let's remember Walsh, because she was writing and talking race, even when people of different racial backgrounds are brought together in everyday democracy, they have not only lived separately in the same city, but they interpret life in the same city very differently. They essentially don't see the same city the same way.
I'm Michael Norton. I'm an associate professor at Harvard Business School and the co-author of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. I want to talk to you today about a piece that we have in the July-August issue of Harvard Business Review. But before I tell you what's in that piece, I first want to ask you to play a game with me. You're looking at an array of faces right now, and I'm going to ask you to play a version of the game that you may have played as a little kid that was called Guess Who? And if you remember that game, you and a partner both had faces in front of you. One of you had a face, and the other person had to guess the face you were looking at from that array of faces. I want you to play this game with me right now. Grab a partner and pick a face that your partner is going to have to guess. And the only rule is your partner can only ask you questions that you can answer with the words yes or no. Pause this video and take a few minutes to play the game. When you're done playing the game, come back, hit unpause, and I'll tell you more about the research that we've conducted.
So grab a partner and play the game. Okay.
So you finished the game. How did it go? What kinds of questions did your partner ask you?
Okay.
Maybe they asked, is this person smiling or not?
Quiet.
Or is this person wearing a hat or not? Or maybe they asked a question like, is this person black or not? But if they did, that would be quite unusual, because in the research that we've done, we find people are very, very reluctant to ask about race when we have them play the exact game that you just played. Why are people reluctant? It appears as though they feel that by asking about race, it might signal that they care a lot about race, and it might even signal that they might be a racist. We find in our experiments that even though the array was half white and half black, and asking the question, is the person white or black, a very useful tool for narrowing down the faces, people are really, really reluctant to ask about that question. And in fact, in another version of the game, we find that if we have people play with a black partner, they become even more unlikely to ask about race because they're even more worried that they might appear to be biased when they do that. And there's an even worse outcome, because people who avoid asking about race, even though they are trying to do so to look as though they don't care about race, end up looking more uncomfortable and more biased. I think the dynamics in this game, which you and your partner just experienced, really suggest how complicated and interesting the dynamics are when we talk about race in contemporary America. We also tried some different versions of this game. In one of them, we actually asked not grown-ups to play the game, but for children to play what is, in the end, a children's game. We wondered when we had them play the game you just played whether the same thing might happen. What we found is that older children, by the time they were 9 or 10, actually stopped asking about race in the game. They'd already learned that maybe it's not wise to ask about race. But the kids who were younger, who were 7 and 8, who weren't so concerned about those social norms yet, in fact, were more likely to ask about race. And as a result, they ended up beating the older kids, performing better on the game. We tried one other version of the game. We ran a version of the game that's very much like the one you played again, but with one difference. In this case, all of the faces were white, but each picture had, in the lower corner of the picture, a white or a black dot. And we wanted to see if it's not about race, if it's not about is this person white or black, but more is this dot white or black, if now people would be very willing to use color because it could be so useful for guessing the face. And that is exactly what we see as well. So if it's race, people will not ask the question black or white. But if it's the color of a dot, like the color of paint on a wall, people are perfectly happy to ask about white or black. And it really suggests that it's the social dynamics surrounding race that make us so uncomfortable talking about color. We know in everyday life, people often struggle to describe someone in the workplace who may be of a different ethnicity. And while the motivation comes from a good place, which is, I don't want to be or appear racist, it ends up impeding communication. And organizations that are savvy realize that a good solution to race is not to avoid talking about race, which, as you saw when you played the game, can impede communication between people, but actually acknowledge race openly. One of the things that we see when we talk to companies that are forward-looking in this space is they're being open and honest about racial differences between workers and among workers. Thanks for taking time to play our game. You can learn more about this research in the piece that Evan Applebaum and I wrote, which will appear in the July-August issue of Harvard Business Review. I'm Michael Norton, associate professor at Harvard Business School and co-author of the book Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending.
Well, some of you in the room caught a white perspective in this. When he asked, is this person black? He could have easily asked, is this person white? But he didn't. And then did you catch when he said, and when people are playing the game with a black person, well, what people? I guess white people, right? So colorblindness goes lots and lots of different directions, and yet it's a marvelous video for showing how reluctant we are to talk about race. All right, I want to tell a personal story. Here's my family. We are a multi-religious, multi-racial family, and mostly we're just a family. So we don't talk a lot about race, and we don't talk a lot about politics, although we're very engaged in politics. And I suppose we'd say we're very involved in diversity, that's at the core of our being, really, in many ways. So Chloe, my granddaughter, who's down in this corner and has been our child of ours since she was two, was a junior at Michigan, and I said to her one day, Chloe, you're an excellent student and you've had 4.0s for a long time. How come you've never gone to honors convocation? And she said, Mary Sue recently sent something out about that. I thought it was about honors theses. I'm not interested. So I rise to my full height and I say, but Chloe, it's really important for people to see that students of color also get honors. Why, in the affirmative action case, that was really important for people. Catch people, not white people. That people understand that there's all kinds of students at Michigan. And she went ballistic. She says, I'm not going to honors convocation for you white people to understand. And I went ballistic and said, I'm not white, I'm your grandmother. So race rears its head, and often it rears with emotion. And Chloe and I had to somehow come to terms with, yes, we too can have a personal story about race. I know from working with students over many years at Michigan that many non-majority students at that point, non-majority, feel irritation and frustration at being put in the position to educate clueless people who don't seem to understand anything about other groups' experiences. An African-American woman from Atlanta is exhibiting the same frustration. She served on a panel on those Atlanta race conversations that I mentioned, and she told a story that night about communication with one of her white friends. She says, one night we were sitting around talking, and she said to me, Nedra, I can learn from you. And from that moment on, our friendship changed because she had decided I had something to give her, that is, educate her about race. So emotions in this unreciprocal relationships gets in the way. So what do psychologists know about crossing divides? We actually know quite a bit. We know them from laboratory studies, which are done with college students, typically. Studies of roommates who've been randomly assigned across race. So at the University of Michigan and many other universities, if students want to live with someone they know, they name that person and they're allowed to do it. Otherwise, they're put in the random pool. And therefore, it's possible to do a natural experiment by finding out what happens in those sustained cross-racial relationships as roommates, especially at Michigan during their first year. There are studies of interactions in other educational settings, especially K-12, and there's some community studies. And there are many positives. There's a whole bunch of studies down here at the bottom, which are in tiny print, but you can certainly get the slides later. There are many positives across all these different kinds of studies. There's an association, sometimes even a causal link, between cross-racial interaction and other kinds of cross-divide interactions with active thinking and problem-solving and consideration of multiple perspectives. There's a reduction in unintentional biases and prejudice, what we call implicit bias. There's an effect on increasing positive feelings, not only about the person or persons with whom one is interacting right at that moment, but also members of other groups. More heterogeneous friendships, an increase in egalitarian values, and an increase in commitment to action to reduce disparities. So there's a lot of positives, but there's also a lot of challenges. Across many studies, there's almost a village industry right now of social psychologists discovering all the problems that occur in cross-racial interaction. For whites, there's a concern about appearing prejudiced. There's an arousal of anxiety. There's what we call depleted executive functioning, which is all that stuff where we are able to control impulses, we can do decision making, we can plan ahead. Increased cardiovascular reactivity and nervous behaviors. I think you would say we whites are pretty fragile folks. For non-whites of various different groups, there's concerns about once again being the target of prejudice. After all, there's been a lot of experience with being the target of prejudice. Negative emotions and once again having to develop some compensatory strategies which people of color have learned how to do in order to deal with interracial situations when things go awry and often feeling inauthentic. And there are different motivations for getting together and having these cross-divide conversations and interactions. Here, a lot of the studies have been done in other countries, including in Israel, by Israeli Arabs and Jews. Higher power groups are interested in interaction to discover commonalities across this divide. They're interested in changing ourselves, our individually change, in order for things to get better or greater harmony. And they tend to want to hold disagreements and conflicts for some time later in the conversation. Whereas people from lower power groups are more interested in talking about differences, especially differences in power. They're interested in change, social change, change in structure, change in power. And they want to get together, and if they're going to get together and talk, they want to talk initially about the things that divide us. We don't have to wait down the pike. So there are clear challenges and different motivations that make it difficult to do this. Well, what kind of interventions do psychologists offer? We just had a really great diversity colloquium at the psych department 2 weeks ago by Patricia Devine from Wisconsin. And really all of the interventions that she mentioned, that most people mention, have to do with changing something about ourselves individually. So we have to become aware of our unintentional biases, and there's ways we can do that. We have to maybe create conflict between our egalitarian values and these implicit biases, something that Devine has done a great deal with. Ways of countering stereotypes or doing stereotype replacement, reappraising what's going on in this situation. And then interestingly, since all of these have to do with focus on ourselves, there's also evidence that really an intervention where we focus on other people rather than ourselves is often more effective. We also, as psychologists, offer changes in the immediate situation that could be helpful. And the most common one across social psychology studies these days is changing the expectations about what we're going to do here in this conversation with each other. Shift it from prejudice to shift it to understanding each other. So what they call shifting it from prevention to promotion can make a big difference. But there's woefully little done by psychologists about what actually goes on in the conversations and interactions across race. And that's why intergroup dialogue that I want to turn to now is so important. So this interaction is not just any old talking. It's a particular kind of talking. It's a structured, facilitated, sustained kind of interaction or talking. It's talk that involves sharing ourselves, listening, which we're none too good at, asking questions which we're even less good at, and finding both commonalities and differences. It's talk that focuses on understanding each group's perspectives and the variation within that group as well, increasing intergroup empathy and a motivation to bridge differences. And finally, it's talk that helps us practice intergroup collaboration and action together. And that's what intergroup dialogue tries to do. So what is it? It's two social identity groups. Students choose to be in an intergroup dialogue on a certain topic. Could be on race, could be on gender, sexual orientation, social class, religion, domestic, international. Kartik is over here, has taught a religion one. There are probably other people in the room who have taught others. It's two facilitators, one from each of the identity groups. It's 12 to 16 students. It's a semester-long course, credit-bearing. And it goes over a four-module curriculum, which I'll come to in a bit. And here are the goals. They are those goals of what talk should foster: intergroup understanding, more positive intergroup relationships, and increased collaboration and action. So I'm going to turn now to a video that has Manita Thompson, who's one of the co-directors of this program, talking about what intergroup dialogue is. This is not the greatest video. I think, in fact, the program desperately needs to get a real professional come and do a video for us, but it's the best we have. So bear with me.
The program on intergroup relations offers undergraduate students the opportunity to enroll in courses called intergroup dialogues. These courses bring together students of two or more different social groups. A dialogue may be between members of two races, or between women and men, or between persons of different religions or sexual orientations. A key component of dialogue is a focus on understanding rather than on debate or argument. Instead of trying to convince one another which viewpoint is more legitimate, participants in dialogue seek to understand why other people or other groups sometimes hold a different perspective.
Here's this four-stage curriculum is coming up.
Dialogue is a four-stage process in which we begin by group beginnings or getting to know each other, where students come together and start to learn the process of what dialogue is.
Well, the first time I went there, I felt kind of out of place. I felt that everyone around me was kind of judging me in a way, but when the dialogue got rolling and my facilitators introduced us all and we did a lot of those icebreakers, I felt kind of right at home.
I guess the most challenging is getting like your first word out about your real feelings. I mean, you can tell like the first day or so, like people are just kind of checking the waters, seeing, you know, is it okay if I say this or I say that?
At first I was a little nervous, you know, because you really are pushing your comfort zone boundaries.
Just being completely honest with complete strangers, I think that's probably the most difficult thing that I've had to deal with, in that they aren't going to necessarily, judge me about what I'm saying. They're just going to listen to it and, you know, go off that.
I absolutely loved it just because everyone was so respectful.
The second stage involves students getting to explore their own identity, their social group identity, and try to gain an understanding of what that means for them in their lives, and also get an understanding of other students' social identities.
I've become a little bit more tolerant. I've realized that I do come from a unique experience.
I thought that I didn't have any stereotypes about anybody. I thought that I was the most open-minded person in the world. It wasn't until after a couple of weeks in the dialogue that I began to realize, wait a minute, I thought I didn't have stereotypes, and it turns out I do have stereotypes.
The third stage is when students come together to address pertinent issues that are relevant to their social identity groups. Oftentimes, this is the phase in which most conflict occurs. Participants discuss current issues and learn to manage conflict as part of the process of communicating across difference.
But it was challenging to listen to people say things that I just thought were so sexist or so, you know, wrong. But the more we talked about them and the more I voiced my opinion, the more you were able to see people going, oh, I didn't think about it that way.
I now don't get so angry about different topics or different, I guess I just don't get as angry about things that I used to get angry about, and I just understand people now more than, know where they're coming from now.
It really surprised me at first that many people were committed to sitting down and talking about those kind of issues, and for a long time, I haven't really been aware of that. It's been more of a struggle within our own community, and more like a fight instead of actually sitting down together and talking about things on a common ground and seeing our commonalities.
And so our fourth phase is about learning to take action, whether that's personal action or whether that's action with others to build alliances or to build coalitions among and across groups to build a more socially just society.
In our classes here at the university, you learn so much about inequality in society and different problems that we face. I think it kind of just gives you an opportunity to actually do something about it.
And I saw a change inside of me. I saw a change in some of the people around me. And I thought, you know, that's like pretty great, and that's pretty cool that we can do that here at school, and we can like experience this together and then come out like being like stronger together and being stronger as individuals. And
I've just learned a lot of things this semester from different people that I would have never otherwise talked to on campus. And now I just feel like I have all these friends that I would have never otherwise been brought to so closely.
Oop. I think I touched the one that's not supposed to be touched, right? Okay. I want to say a word about action. Intergroup dialogue is really an intergroup program. But that's not the only kind of action that people take. Many times solidarity action within a group, within African Americans or within white women or within Latino men or whatever. So there's also wonderful social psychological research on collective action. That is action in behalf of a group, usually a lower power group. And it's quite clear that solidarity, internal interaction within the group, is one of the most important sources of getting that kind of action. But this is about intergroup stuff. So this is about intergroup action without in any way demeaning the other. Both are important. It isn't either or. So what is it? Well, our pedagogy involves the standard stuff that any course does. There's lots of readings. There's written assignments. But what distinguishes intergroup dialogue from many other courses is that every class session is full of structured interaction facilitated by trained facilitators. So what does structured interaction mean? Well, it starts with the importance of students defining their own guidelines. What is it they want to make sure happens in this interaction? And they say things like confidentiality that has to stay in this room, or that we talk about ideas and don't demean people, or that I use I statements, not pretending to represent other people, that we own up to our emotions. The young woman in this video talked about how she's no longer angry. Well, you know, people are still angry, and they need to own that up, and we need to talk about what that all is about. We need to learn how to ask why, and so they talk about the importance of asking why as a guideline. So guidelines are crucial as part of structured interaction. And here's another example of structured interaction. This is a web. Each student takes a hold of a piece of the web. And on the web are index cards with statistically, factually based descriptions of something about disparity on that topic. So if it's a gender dialogue, it's about gender disparity. If it's a race dialogue, etc. Some of us have played this game together, a person in the second row here this winter with in my class. So in this web, people are supposed to be quiet while we listen to each person reading an index card. And then the facilitator should ask, would one person drop their piece of the web? And sequentially, each person drops a piece of the web until there's one person left holding a little piece of the web. And then the facilitator should say, what did we learn here? And what we're hoping students learn is a visual representation of the interdependence of how institutions work together to either create inequality or to maintain inequality. Our problems are not just the educational system. It's the transportation system. It's the housing issues. It's the economy. It's all this stuff interconnected. That also means that when we're trying to solve and create social change, you don't just work on one institution. It requires the whole web. So many of our students have learned all this in many sociology classes and even in some psychology classes, but this makes it visual, and then they really get it, that there's something about the web that has to be taken into account if we're going to have social change. That also means they learn that comfort zones and safe havens and places on our campus where students gather with each other who look like them are actually very important places, and they aren't alternatives to interacting across difference. They are also the both and instead of either or. One of the most powerful exercises that we do is called testimonials. It's storytelling. It turns out we know a lot about how important storytelling is from neuroscience work of late. And what we ask the students to do is to tell a 5-minute story about how they became aware of their social identity on this topic, let's say a race dialogue or a gender dialogue, and the identities of others. And after each person tells their testimonial, the rest of the students are to ask a couple questions to get a greater depth in that story. Testimonials are the most powerful tool we have because students learn about each other's experiences in a very genuine way that they can't discount that somehow it doesn't really happen. All the stuff that they hear actually happens, and it's their peers they're hearing it from.
The different privileges and discriminations that the other classmates were facing, dealing with gender, ethnic identity, religion, and many others. I learned a lot from the readings, but I learned most from the experiences of everyone else around me.
So she's just telling why testimonials and structured interactions are so important. All right, facilitators, what do they do? Well, they're supposed to ask questions and get students to ask each other questions. They're supposed to listen actively and press for patterns in what students are talking about. They're supposed to help connect and integrate what's going on in the conversation, challenge what's said, not the people, but the ideas and the comments, and to reflect and redirect. Now, most of us who've run discussions in communities or discussions in our places of worship or in classrooms know the discussion often gets away from us. And the biggest skill we can have as facilitators is how to reflect and redirect back to something that's important. What they shouldn't do, they shouldn't passively listen, and they shouldn't advocate in a way that shuts down dialogue. Yeah, facilitators have positions, but they're not to do They're not to express those positions in ways that cut off conversation among the students. Here's a student talking about a facilitator that helped her see patterns in the conversation in the testimonials. And she says, after everyone had given their testimonials, we were asked if we saw any general patterns in what students had shared. It wasn't very hard to see them once we were asked to look for the patterns. One was that nearly all the white students said they didn't have a racial identity. Another was the opposite, how easily students of color talked about identity. That doesn't mean that every white person and every student of color disclosed exactly the same stories. The stories were rich and individual, but still the pattern was clear. Maybe we would have seen it even without the facilitators, but just being asked to look for patterns really helped. Well, what makes it work? Distinctive communication processes of two sorts. One we call dialogic, and these processes are just as pertinent for any conversation being held anywhere. It doesn't have to be in an intergroup dialogue classroom. Storytelling, active listening, learning how to do active listening. It doesn't come naturally. You have to learn to do it. Learning how to ask questions and follow up each other's ideas and use inquiry methods. And seeking understanding, asking the question why. Those dialogic processes, I've been involved in running faculty institutes. In fact, Teresa Satterfield is here, who's one of the people at one of them, went to one of them, where these kinds of dialogic processes are pertinent to every classroom, to every time we try to talk about something important. We also talk about critical processes, which is really helping students learn to identify the assumptions that are underlying what people are saying. Like, it wasn't obvious that this Harvard associate professor business school person was taking a white perspective, but of course he was. It's just learning to get at the assumption underneath what's being said. A critical analysis of inequalities and learning to do personal and collective reflection. Every session of an intergroup dialogue course should end with the facilitator saying, what did we learn here today? We faculty assume people learn what we've talked or what we've taught, but they don't. Instead, if we ask them what they've learned, then they are going to collectively come up with something that they may remember as they walk home from class. Rinku Sen, who's the president and executive director of a group called Race Forward, and she publishes a news site, Color Lines, says that the best way to begin a conversation about race is by asking questions. She tells the story of standing in line for Sundance film tickets and began chatting with a white woman behind her. She said, at the comments the white woman was making, she wanted to roll her eyes, but instead she asked a question. Typically, why the woman felt or thought the way she did. And each time, the woman refined what she said, gave nuance to it, and even questioned herself. Questions work, but we really often don't know how to do questions. In my experience at Michigan, I think most of our discussion sections are serial monologues in which one person makes a statement and all the other students can hardly wait to make their own statements. But rarely do students ask each other questions or follow up each other's ideas. So storytelling and question asking are what makes it work. All right, I want to turn very briefly now to the research. At the end of 2002, when I knew the Supreme Court was going to make its decision in 2003, I knew that there were a lot of weaknesses in the research that was available for the expert testimony that I and others wrote. So I wanted something that would be experimental. There were very, very few experimental studies on the impact of diversity. And what we did was to gather together with people from 9 universities, including Michigan, that had intergroup dialogue programs, and where we could do a field experiment trying to tie down what happens when you leverage diversity in an explicit way. So what we did was to try to determine, does intergroup dialogue have those three effects that we talked about? Increasing intergroup understanding, especially about inequality, increasing intergroup relationships of a positive sort, especially empathy and motivation to bridge difference, and increasing collaboration and action. Do we have those effects? Given randomization of the students into these either dialogue courses or into the waitlist control groups, an effect is a larger change from the beginning to end of the semester among the students in the dialogue courses who were randomly assigned to be there compared to the students who were randomly assigned to the waitlist control groups. And here's the design. Well, here's the people. So these are the nine universities, all but one, you know, Arizona. All the others are sort of places where people from Michigan, either staff or faculty or grad students, went off to develop intergroup dialogue programs. And here's the design. Because students cannot immediately enroll in intergroup dialogue courses, they have to apply. And this study was on race dialogues and gender dialogues. It meant when a student applied for a race dialogue at any one of these nine universities, that student could be randomly assigned either to the course or to a waitlist control group. When they applied for a gender dialogue, they could be likewise randomly assigned either to the course or to a waitlist control group. Both groups got a pretest at the beginning of the term in which the dialogue course was offered. The experimental group is the dialogue group, and that's the experimental variable up there. It's the intergroup dialogue course. And at the end of the term, both groups are given the same post-test, and a year later, they're given the same longitudinal follow-up survey. And here are the participants. We essentially ran 52 pairs, 26 pairs of race and 26 pairs of gender. What's a pair? A pair is a dialogue course and a waitlist control group offered the same semester. So 52 pairs, 26 race, 26 gender, across those nine universities. 726 students were in the dialogue courses, 721 in the waitlist control groups, and we selected students within categories, demographic categories, so that we would have approximately an equal proportion of white men, men of color, white women, and women of color. Now, we know that all students of color are not alike. But even at the University of Michigan, that has the longest standing intergroup dialogue program and the largest program in the country, we don't have enough students of color applying to be in intergroup dialogue courses to pair up a dialogue that involves white students, let's say, with Latino students or African-American students with Arab students. It's just not possible. So it's a very clear limitation of this study. We had approximately equal as we expected to have, and you can see what proportions of the students of color were African-American, Asian-American, Latino, and other. We also did a lot of qualitative work, which I'm not talking about today. In 10 race dialogues and 10 gender dialogues, one at each of the institutions other than Michigan and two here, we did a videotaping of an early, a mid, and a late session. We then interviewed all the students in those 20 dialogue courses, 248 students. And then what was most exciting, really, in many ways, because it's a standard curriculum at all nine universities, the students were answering questions for a final paper that was the same paper at all nine universities. So we content analyzed 720 papers. And what did we learn? Well, on intergroup empathy, this is a multi-item measure of intergroup empathy. They start out the same. The dialogue students are the green line. The control group is the yellow line. 4 months later, that's at the end of the term, the dialogue students have increased significantly in intergroup empathy, and the control group students have not. Then there's some fading. Guess what? Learning fades, although we often don't believe that happens to us in our classrooms. And at the end of a year, that difference over there is still a statistically reliable difference between the two groups. Pretty much the same picture on understanding the structural sources of inequality, and pretty much the same picture, except there's some increase in the year following the end of the intergroup dialogue course in that subsequent year for both groups. And again, that difference at the end is still a reliable difference. Now, these are small differences. What's important is that they're consistent across many measures. So in this national study, or this multi-diversity study, we had 24 measures of psychological processes, intergroup understanding, intergroup relationships, and intergroup action. And there was that significant effect. Remember what it is. It's a bigger change among the dialogue students than among the students in the control groups on 20 of those 24. In both race and gender dialogues, with all four groups of students, and they were still evident a year later on actually 21 of the 24. Well, structured, facilitated, sustained conversations don't have to be intergroup dialogue. They can occur in K-12 classrooms. They can happen in religious institutions, not only within but between. They can happen within political parties, and in fact, in many ways, that's exactly what's happening in this election this year. I wouldn't call it a dialogue, but we're certainly seeing lots and lots of conversation and conflict within both parties. PTAs and community groups, libraries like here, families and neighbors and neighborhood associations. So this stuff is relevant everywhere. It's not just in an intergroup dialogue course. In fact, colleagues of mine in this program have used the dialogue pedagogy, especially those dialogic processes of listening, asking questions, getting students to ask questions of each other, asking why, motivation to bridge differences. Those kinds of processes are relevant for every kind of conversation. Kelly Maxwell and I work with CRLT in this faculty workshop that we've been doing every May for some time. It's not for intergroup dialogue classes, it's just for using dialogic approaches in the classroom. All of us are involved in this program and running an annual National Institute in June. Over the last 9 years, we've had about 150 different institutions coming to Michigan to learn something about how do you do this work. This year in June, there'll be another 35 institutions. Roger Fisher, who's a co-director of this program, and Barry Checkaway, who's a professor in social work, run high school age summer dialogue programs in the Detroit metropolitan area where students are paired up by neighborhoods. So it could be Grosse Pointe in southwest Detroit, where it's not attached to schools, it's attached to community-based organizations, and the students go for a couple of weeks within groups in their own neighborhoods and then across groups, and they end up at Michigan for a three-day retreat on how they're going to carry forward their understanding of crossing racial divides. And many of my colleagues, friends, consult with people across many different institutions all over the country. So why is all this important? Very briefly. Well, mostly it's the demography of the country. We all know that by 2050 we will be a majority-minority or minority-majority, whichever way we want to call it, maybe 2042. And this is why. In 2011, there were 2.5 times as many non-white babies as white babies born. And guess what? They're going to grow up, and they will be 18 years of age, and then there'll be 2.5 times as many kids of color as there are white kids. And so this is an inexorable kind of looking picture of what our country is to look like. So demography plays a very big part. Here's higher education projections for 2050. This is on the side of community colleges, where over half are expected to be Latinos, 25% whites, 15% Asian background, 8% African Americans. The other is four-year public institutions. It doesn't look very different. In 2050, it's expected that only private four-year liberal arts schools will still have a majority of white students. In addition, we need these conversations across difference in order to grab hold of the other enormous divide in this country, which has to do with economic inequality. We all know the facts because now in the past 2 years, inequality is really in the news. Believe me, it was not until 2 years ago. So the top 10% of households have 80% of the financial wealth. You're hearing Bernie Sanders endlessly talk about the 1%. So everyone in this room is being educated at every Bernie Sanders rally. The bottom 80% have 7% of the wealth. And guess what? The United States doesn't fare very well in the world. There are 100 countries that have less income inequality than we do. We're 101st in the world. 9 European countries have less inequality than we do, and so does Canada. Now, this doesn't mean that the poor here are as worse off as the poor in many other countries. It's the difference between the top and the bottom that we're talking about in terms of the size of inequality. And then there's our exceptionalism, that somehow there's great social mobility in the United States. Well, not so much. It's harder for Americans to rise from lower economic rungs than people in Canada, Norway, Finland, Sweden, those are not so surprising, Germany, France, but even Great Britain, that we think of as a class-based society. If, of course, all these inequalities were evenly distributed across all social groups, it would still be a very serious issue in this country. But, of course, it's not evenly distributed. The median net worth of white households is 18 times that of Latino households, 20 times that of African-American households. All households' net worth went down after the Great Recession in 2008. So between 2005 and 2009, median net worth went down 16% for white households, 66% for Latino households, and 53% for African-American households. Why all this? Because conversations across difference, crossing social divides, will help us understand a great deal about what's happening to a democracy that works incredibly well compared to most democracies in the world or most countries in the world. But this kind of conversation has to include this stuff. I want to end with a slide that's from Yo-Yo Ma. This is Yo-Yo Ma and the musicians from some musicians from the Silk Road Ensemble. I heard this with a session with Charlie Rose. And Yo-Yo Ma was making the case that world music or the Silk Road Ensemble experience contributes to the solution of economic and political problems by fostering imagination, flexibility, empathy, collaboration, and thus innovation. And then 3 musicians from the Silk Road Ensemble talked. And they talked about how it was putting together what you don't know from diverse music traditions to now making it something that you can include in your own. And of course, that means innovation in music. And they talked about how critically important it had been for them to learn to listen and ask questions of each other in order to grab hold of what those diverse music traditions meant. And that's what I think crossing divides has to mean in 21st century America and also across the globe. That's it.